This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
As we call this one, this session is called Placing Emily. As you can see from this morning, there's a whole range of ways of looking at her work in a whole different frames. And, you know, and some people say, well, why do we talk about it when we just look at it? Well, you can as well, you know, but somehow rather in terms of art history, and when you have such an international profile as she now has, it's unavoidable to actually talk about her and try and position her in order to extract additional dimensions to viewing her work. As you know, if you go on a tour, if you go to work first up, to an exhibition first up, and just see the work, you have a particular personal response. If you go on a guided tour with somebody, you actually get something else as well, and then if you go again or you read some more or you see a film, you get something else again. It's not that one thing's better than the other or that one thing's replacing the personal response. They're all part of gaining and increasing one's understanding and or appreciation. So that's all part of the game. So this one, Placing Emily, first person, is Christopher Hodges, who is an artist and gallery owner. And he's been exhibiting since the late 1970s, both solo exhibitions and inclusion in many other group shows. His work is included in public, private and corporate collections. As the owner and director of Utopia Art Sydney since 1988, Christopher is an acknowledged expert in the field of contemporary and Indigenous art. In addition to shows in his gallery, he has curated many shows for other venues and contributed to many significant exhibitions, national and international, and public and commercial galleries. Now, the interesting connection here between Christopher and Emily, of course, is he was a great mate of Rodney Gooch, and if you've read any background, and they had a lot to do with the Utopia artists hitting the canvas in 1988, which happens to be the year that Utopia Art Sydney was started, which was part of promoting that community who had no art centre and to this day probably still hasn't. They've had sort of fledgling attempts at it, which is an interesting point. If there's an arts, you know, Emily is a non-art centre artist. And it's a very treacherous area, which we won't go into right now. But Rodney Gooch and Christopher Hodges need to be acknowledged for the work that they did in those days with the Utopia community, which Emily was one of the painters, for actually being very thoughtful about how they encouraged the artists, how they gave them all equal money for their work, how they thought about placing that first body of work that came out of Utopia in 1989. With the then Robert Holmes the Court Foundation collection, after which there were exhibitions. There was then a Karma Utopia Artist in Residence run through the then Robert Holmes the Court Foundation. And all of those few very well-placed, well-targeted arrangements, which was simply not about investment, was simply about giving the Utopian artists an opportunity to paint on canvas like their peers who were doing so in the Western Desert and had been for the 10 years previous. So there's a whole lot of history there, and so and also for me, doing an exhibition like this, when somebody like Christopher, who's part of that whole history, knew Emily very well, has lots of anecdotes, who earned the trust and respect of Emily to the point of when I did this exhibition, I didn't want to become another person from down south humbugging that lady for something. So Christopher and Rodney already had that trust and respect of the old lady, so I worked mostly through them. Therefore, I'm very grateful, and anyone who appreciates the exhibitions they see of Emily also must appreciate the contribution of people like Christopher and Rodney Gooch. So with that, I'd like Mr. Hodges to come forward and talk about an artist first and foremost.
Very good. Look, button workers, isn't it?
Don't ask me about buttons. He's asking me about buttons.
As always, my dear friend Margot starts to pinch half my talk before I get to it. Are we working here? But I'll forgive her. She brought up... welcome. Thank you for having me. Margot brought up so many points just in her introduction there that I can't help but to go back to one of them. The idea of art centres and Rodney Gooch. In 1988, when I bumped into a woman from Karma Shop with a bag of batik that she'd just failed to sell at an exhibition here in Canberra, in Sydney, and I sold that thing, I got a phone call from Rodney Gooch, and it was an angry phone call, you know, bring that stuff back, I need it, quick, give it back to me. And I said, you know, hang on a minute, mate, hang on, wait. I said, I can't give it back to you. He said, well, what have you done with it? I said, I've sold it. Oh, that'd be right. And I said, I've just been waiting for you to get in touch with me so I can send you the check. Oh, that was the beginning of my relationship with Rodney Gooch. Now, Rodney Gooch was the director of Karma Shop, Aboriginal-owned organisation, and Rodney had been asked, as the director of Karma Shop, to actually take on the management of the Utopia Women's Boutique out of the community of Utopia. And the story that Rodney told me was that he was given a piece of foolscap paper with a map drawn on the back of it in Biro as to where all the places were, and a promise that there would be some funding coming. And that's how he began, through Karma, representing the Utopia Women's Boutique and representing that community in the proper ethical way that any representative should. It was a community-based organisation. Utopia Women's Boutique had started many years earlier, and it wasn't till later that a bunch of other people stuffed it. But here we go. That was an introduction that I wasn't planning to make, but it fits quite nicely into 1988. In 1988, the image of Utopia that's conjured in your mind is a brilliant place. And when I first went to Utopia to visit, it was the great floods of Alice Springs in 1988. And the whole of the Alice Springs district was covered in water, and we couldn't get to the Utopia community for our first visit. And Helen and I flew into Alice Springs and arrived about 3 a.m. in the morning with the intention of going out to see these wonderful people, which we never got to till much later. But the idea of Utopia has always stuck with me as a beautiful thought and a beautiful analogy for these wonderful women and how they fit together in the world. Anyway, what we're looking at here is the landscape of a part of the Utopia community called Al Alkara. And at the basis of all of Emily Nwaré's art, there is this place called Al Alkara, which you all must know and understand. As Emily has often said, the stories that run through that land, the stories that created that land, the ancestors that made those stories, the pencil yam, the roots from the ground, the little dingo puppy that ran by it, all these stories interwoven inextricably with the landscape, the geography, the actual events that are happening now and in the past, formed an amalgam in her mind, a whole universe, and can be explained in a simple way. The word awulia means this body paint that you put on your body. But it also means that dance, that song, that ceremony. And it also means that whole consciousness of being that forms that place, Al Alkara. Now, if you think about all that, you can tell any one of those stories by doing footprints and in the sand or sites and places. But to form that whole concept and be able to portray that, it calls for a new vision, a vision that's not just one thing. And Professor Tatahata declared that Emily Nwaré was a genius. And he said that the genius was formed by the fact that this woman, who had no idea of Western art history, who had an education of traditional Aboriginal history from her land, who grew up at a time when the only land she knew, the only world she knew, was this block of land called Al Alkara and its neighbours, had no concept of the globe, and it's certainly no concept of Western art history, was able to have in her mind this strong vision of her country. And when the opportunity came to use modern materials to make paintings and batiks, was able to invent something that was absolutely striking and new. It was something that her culture had never had before, but it was something that all cultures, and we're going, as we've seen from the exhibitions overseas now, all cultures can embrace and be associated with. But Emily was a woman of opportunity. You might think back to 1988, it doesn't seem that long ago, but in 1988, Helen and I bought our first piece of business equipment. It was a brand new thing. It was a fax machine. And it cost $2,000. And that piece of equipment in 1988 was the latest technology. And now we're pressing buttons, hoping... Look. We'll stay with this one. But in the 1970s, a couple of young women, Jenny Green and Julia Murray, were working out at the Utopias community as in education ways, and they saw a group of women who attended the school every day with their kids and with their family, and they weren't doing anything. They were just waiting for the children. And they started a program, and at first you can see Emily Nuare there, and on the left her constant companion, Lily Nuare, and they've got a piece of tie-dyed fabric, which was the first opportunity that was provided for the women of Utopia to do something that would in turn make them some money, an income. This first tie-dyeing thing was more or less a thing carried over from the hippie days where people made T-shirts and... Could we get a fax machine? But they went on to make T-shirts and singlets, and here you can see Emily with a singlet on, a singlet that she's made, and that there's a young man there has gone on to do a couple of things, and his mother's probably very proud of him these days.
He's wearing the singlet, not Emily.
Yeah, sorry, he's wearing the singlet.
Actually, he was saying how nice now, he couldn't, but he packed his singlet.
Did he? Well, at this particular occasion's in the early, this is early 88, and Emily was, this is one of the first, certainly the first time that Peter met Emily. Yep. Are these pictures looking okay to you? Because they look completely different to me than they do to you. Okay. The women of Utopia then got the opportunity to make batik, and when Rodney Gooch came along, one of the big things that he did was he encouraged women to tell their stories, not just to make patterns, and many women were making stories before this. But you can see in there Emily Nuare, Ruby Nuare there, and they're holding out one of the works that became part of the first big collection of batiks. And one of the things that a good art advisor does is to do things that really show the quality of the artist that he's representing. And this was the first project I met with Rodney Gooch. He showed me 88 pieces of silk that the women had done, each telling their own story, and it was a major step forward in the development of that community. And the word community is very important because in those early days, every person in that community was a part of it. And when anything was done, it was done with complete transparency. All the money that changed hands was done in public. One woman took the fall, everything was shown to every other woman in it. It was a great time, and you can see this is a golden age, really. Now, this is the batik that the National Gallery of Australia owns by Emily Nuare. This was purchased in 1982. Emily Nuare was just not a name that anyone had heard of. None of the women from Utopia were known public names. And a curator from the National Gallery of Australia, searching through a bag of batiks in the foyer of a hotel in Melbourne, picked this work out just because it was as it turns out, a great piece of work. And it's in the exhibition. And if you want to look at this, you can see the underlying structure. You can see the lines of dots. You can even see the lines of body paint. You can see overlay, underlay of images. You can see somebody that's working through a whole series of ideas in the one picture. And this is Emily Nuare, 1982, unknown, undiscovered, and the work was picked solely on the power of the piece of fabric itself. No name, just the power of the fabric. This is a detail from the first batik of Emily Nuare's that I ever saw. This was hanging on the wall of Rodney Gooch's guest room the first time we stayed at his place in Alice Springs. And you hear that thing, the shock of the new. And it made a lasting impression. You woke up in the morning and this is what you looked at. And I had never seen anything like it before. Now, a lot of art dealers would say this was the moment I made the great discovery and this is where we everything after that was a piece of cake. It wasn't like that at all. It was just that you identified in this piece there was something going on. Look at the structure. Look at the simplicity of the work. And Grace Cochran purchased this for the Powerhouse Museum many, many, many years later. And she was absolutely thrilled that this was in the exhibition. And it was that contact that people make of Emily through a piece of artwork. And many people last night looking at this exhibition had just that thing, that contact. Now, Emily believed that when you looked at one of her paintings, that you would understand everything about Al-Alqra, that you would know. And she'd look you in the eye and say, you know. Well, she'd look me in the eye and say, you know. She got very, very assured that she could pack into these pictures enough for you to be moved. And I think that she's been a great success at it. In the early days at Alice Springs, people who were walking through Karma Shop, a community shop that had the good, the bad and the ugly spread everywhere, one of her works would be over in the corner and somebody, that people would gravitate towards it. You've got no idea. People who weren't art connoisseurs, people who were tourists, who were just looking for a piece of Aboriginal work to take back, but they'd gravitate to these funny combinations of dots. Now, this is her first show in 1990, the very first solo exhibition that was ever staged. There's works from this exhibition, the work on this end here is in this exhibition in the museum. And there are other works from this very first exhibition in the museum. See, Emily arrived at painting a fully formed individual. She arrived to make her first canvas completely with a set of images and ideas ready to go down. They were complex ideas, so they couldn't be just simple stories, simple narratives. And the only way she could turn was abstraction. And these simple fields of dots done in very early days managed to capture that whole essence of Al-Alqra, that whole spirit of place. And if you look at these pictures carefully, you can see down on the one at the end there, you can see the underlying root structure, as it's called, sometimes mapping structure, as I call it on other days, and this veil of dots shimmering through the landscape. Now, people will tell you that there's lots of funny names given to paintings, There's one was, that are more descriptive names given by others. But Emily would just simply touch that painting sometimes, and she'd sometimes get a little song, and you'd ask her, "What's that?" And she'd just go, "You know, whole lot, finished." And after a while, I couldn't ask her the question anymore. So they all remain untitled Al-Alqra. Now, you can see the range of pictures. This is the very first solo exhibition. This set of five panels, which is in the exhibition next door, shows that lovely tracery and almost a cosmology. You can almost feel like you're looking at the stars there as much as you can feel like you're looking at the Earth. And this lovely piece here, which a dear friend, Hugh Jamieson, purchased for his Allan Hemsey collection. This was, I think, the second contemporary Aboriginal work of art that ever got purchased for that significant collection, and it wasn't the last. And it was groundbreaking to see contemporary collectors looking at this work, not just Aboriginal collectors. And part of my mission as a representative of Emily's work was to get her in the Australian art section of the museum as a leading contemporary artist, not in the Aboriginal section. Now, you might think that that's funny because I think that... But I always thought that she was a great artist of this age and not a great artist of another age. She was living and communicating to me, to you, her story, her ideas, a great cognitive development, really. She was a woman who had she was 80 when she, she was old when she started, if you like. So she knew she didn't have forever to do this work. And so there were fast changes. And you can see that she went from those little dots, then she got to some bigger dots, and then she got into colour. And If you want to take that journey through that, you can make a chronology of the size of the dots, if you like, as she goes through and explores. But you can also see that from little pictures, she's starting to branch out into some full-scale dynamic works where she's handling the scale with great aplomb. The confidence in those big, bold compositions goes, if you look at the work on the end wall there, that pale mauve work, which, you know, which is one of my favourite works. And it's just this lovely field. You know, I always think of that as Emily Noiré's Lavender Mist. It's just this beautiful, pale zone. But this picture on the right-hand side of the picture, which we always call Cockatoo, a few of these pictures get nicknames. And that one's called Cockatoo, nicknamed Cockatoo, because of those bright colours, especially those flashes of yellow coming through the centre of it. Now, those two pictures were done about 6 months apart. And you can see that she was not just sitting on her laurels. See, she could have stayed making those cute little dot pictures forever and they would have sold forever, but she didn't. Every chance she got, every opportunity presented, it was an opportunity that she took. In 1992, this exhibition at my gallery included on the right-hand side this very big picture here, which was in 5 metres long. It arrived the day of the exhibition, and it was a big hole to fill if it didn't come. But that picture there was the largest scale work that she'd ever done to that stage. When we saw that picture in Tokyo, at 5 metres long, it was hung vertically. And people there were shocked because they'd always ever seen this very long, skinny picture. But when it was hung vertically, it had the presence of a scroll. It had that lovely sense of falling and you know, just gently cascading down. It's a great picture. And that's it getting installed in the Art Gallery of New South Wales, who eventually bought it. Now, this is a landmark purchase for the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and curator John Mundine is here. And I can remember Barry Pearce, the head of Australian art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, at that stage saying, we'll probably buy 20 major works and that'll do us forever, of Aboriginal painting. And he denies that now. But this on the left is a curator called Deborah Edwards, the curator of in contemporary art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And she was instrumental in getting this picture hung there so that the trustees could come and look at this picture. And it really did make a big difference because John put together an amazing collection for the Art Gallery of New South Wales, but with an emphasis towards the top of Australia. And this was the first big purchase of a contemporary modern painting for the Art Gallery. Now, the Clemenger Prize at the National Gallery of Victoria is an invitational prize, and it's going to be on very soon for the last time. And Emily Noiré was one of the first Indigenous artists ever invited to participate. And Rodney and I were discussing this with Emily, and I put to her that this was a really important exhibition. It was a very big gallery, and she could do something really very special to impress the people of the Clemenger Prize judges. And she didn't win, but in that competition was also a very famous artist, Rosalie Gascoigne, who I very much admire, and a local Canberra resident. And this big picture, it looks fabulous at the heart of this exhibition in here. And I remember the door opened, and James Mollison was the director of the National Gallery of Victoria at the time, and he announced to all the contestants before they went in who'd won so that they weren't shocked when the general public was looking at them. And Rosalie Gascoigne didn't win, and she went, and the door opened, and there was Emily's big picture in front of her. And she said, I didn't know you could do that. And she looked at it. It just stopped. And it's a transfixing picture. It's a very ramshackle picture. It's a picture that's quite rambunctious. It doesn't behave itself. It's not particularly beautiful, but it's a very strong picture. And when that was finished, that was all separate canvases, all laid out on the floor, and it had the presence to really challenge everything that you knew about contemporary Aboriginal painting, and it certainly challenged what was happening, you know, in the general art world in Australia at the time. Okay. But just to digress a second, the way paintings look depends on where they're shown. And this is how it was shown in the gallery, my gallery, a very close, intimate, personal sort of meeting with the picture. You walked sort of through it. And it was a very different effect to when it was at the Clemenger Prize. The photograph that you saw first was when it was at the National Gallery of Australia, hanging there one day. They changed the hang and had that very lateral presence. And now, in the centre of this exhibition, I think it's got the most wonderful sense of that you're in the centre of the universe. You're in the centre of the city. You're in the place that you should be. And so this is called the Al Alkara Suite. It's a name that I gave it, and Emily thought was okay, we're fine. But to me, this is one of the biggest, bravest paintings that she ever did. Of course, the big shock that happens as people move through a body of her work is that she doesn't. She's not well mannered, and if you look at the one to the skinny one in the middle. I wish this was the proper pictures because it looks better, but you're only getting the middle slice of it. But the one in the middle, the centre picture, you can see the size of the brush strokes there it's in this exhibition, and the brush strokes are about this size, like almost a small saucer size. And she had been given the creative fellowship by the Keating government, and great awards to acknowledge artists that were doing something special. She was the first Indigenous person to receive it, and she was absolutely thrilled at that recognition. The way that picture was painted was with a very big brush. Now, some of you who will be students of Emily's work will understand that she used to dip the brush in paint, quite often a couple of colours, and then she'd put the brush downwards onto the canvas like that, meaning the bristles would spread out, and this would give you that floret shape. And she'd spied a very big brush, which eventually she managed to get off me, and she used it to make those paintings. Now, if you go and look at that painting out in the exhibition after this, you'll see a painting that's made of this funny blue, this funny brown, red ochre, if you like, and white. And if you're a painter, go home, get those three colours, and try and do that painting. To keep it clean and to keep the colours pure and not end up with a big puddle of mud, you've got to be pretty canny. And those paintings, really, to me, are an interesting thing. She got that award. She said she was going to give up painting, which she had a break for a little while. And then she painted that group of paintings, which are really quite calm. They're quite simple, quite spacious. And I think capture a side of her spirit as a painter that she didn't get an opportunity to do too often in those times. This is Rodney Gooch, Emily Nwaare, and Lily Nwaare, and if you can't quite see it, just over Rodney Gooch's left-hand shoulder there's a little rolled-up tube of paper. And this is Emily. Emily and Lily were living here just out near the shop at Alice Springs at one stage, and that little tube of paper ends up being that painting in the middle, which is in this exhibition here. And that painting was the first painting that had any sense of structure that wasn't those little petals, right? Now, in 1994, Emily was very unwell, and she was unable to paint. And Rodney rang me, and he said, Emily wants to paint, but she's not well enough to paint. And I said, why don't you give her some paper or something that's lightweight, and she can just do something on that so it's not heavy and it's easy to do. And she painted a series of paintings that were white pieces of paper with black stripes on them. Now, those paintings are called awulia, body paint paintings, but it was a time when she was a little bit sad, she was a little bit unwell, and she painted those lovely, simple stripes. And as James Mollison said, the first series are in the National Gallery of Victoria, as James Mollison said, they're black lines on white paper. But why are they so good? Well, they were good because they had meaning, because they had content, because she, as an artist, was portraying something that was more than just, a decorative line. The black and red one on the end, this grey and black one here, all very powerful, somber works in many ways. They're not, they're not hit the highlights. And I think that in time, these pictures are going to get great recognition. The way that she developed through this series of works was quite interesting too, because Emily didn't just work for Rodney and me. She was doing paintings for a broad number of people at this stage. But she was doing these only for Rodney because nobody else knew of them and therefore couldn't ask for them. And she had a time when she made this very somber series of works which just sing quietly. I love these works. They're just superb. She went to the Venice Biennale. I just include this because it's got that nice greeny one in the middle. And these were the works that represented her at the Venice Biennale. At the Venice Biennale, people have said of the Australian Pavilion that this woman in the Australian Pavilion was copying Sol LeWitt. Sol LeWitt, an American artist who did do some linear work at the time, came and saw the exhibition. Sol LeWitt said, "This woman's fabulous," and through a friend of his, acquired work. It's an interesting thing, you see. Emily suddenly ended up in the middle of the contemporary art world, and people immediately said she was copying. But in fact, that, as Professor Tatahata said, that was the moment where people realised that something special had gone on, that a woman who had no history of Western art suddenly was being recognised and applauded by great artists from around the world. And it was artists that in the Venice that actually really responded to her work. The way she used colour was also something that's interesting because she'd done those very sombre black and white works. But look at this green and yellow thing, you know. It could have been a new sketch for the Australian flag. You know, you could have worn that to the Olympic Games and people would have thought that you were really an Australian person. But the combination of that linear pattern with the dots was started to really catch on. I might tell you that the first exhibition we did of those stripe works, another dealer rang me up and said, "What are you doing? You're killing the goose that laid the golden egg." And I said, "No, I'm not," but he thought I was. Actually, several people said that what I had done was a disgrace and that by showing this new work, this new direction, that I was going to ruin all that had gone before. It's interesting, isn't it? See, a lot of people in the art world really care for art and for artists, but there's another bunch that only care for money. And the people that care for money only want to have things that look like what it should look like that they think they should sell, whereas those that represent artists ethically and properly are trying to show what the artist has got, what the artist is made of, the true substance of the work. And those works are really good. There's an interesting thing here. This is just an aside. On the right-hand side and left-hand side, you'll see some little dotty works with quite a lot of space surrounding them. They were done at the same time that she was doing the spare lines on the canvas and were very floaty. And the picture to the left was done about the same time too. And you can see in that there's a combination of the lines of stripes, there's the sense of the underpainting, there's a sense of a top layer and a bottom layer. There's a great sense of depth and openness and space in those works. It's interesting to see how she started to meld the different styles together. Yeah, just another terrific couple of pieces. In 1995, she's moved on, and the movement is quite profound. These works you'll see in the exhibition, the one down the end there, is one of the called Myrna, and Myrna was the first really bold gestural scribbly painting that she did that really is still one of my favourite paintings. But on the right here, you can see a series of works. They're not the greatest shots, I'm afraid, but you can see they're very broadly brushed. These works done in 1995 give us an indication of the works that she does in the very last period of her life. And they're all over misty, spiritual sort of pictures, which hark back to those little fields of dots in the beginning, if you think about it, and those big brushstroke ones in the middle. Look at the energy in this. And in the top left-hand corner, see the handprints? And the hands, and all of us that remember that motion of touching the canvas and singing, it just feels like the hands touching. It's beautifully done. Now, these structural, rooty, mappy sorts of pictures start to really grow and start to become the powerful dimension of her work. And we end up with on the left-hand side, the big yam painting, which everybody knows and is an icon of absolute persistence. Most artists, if you ask them, you've got, here's a canvas, it's as big as from here to here, it lays on the floor from there out to here, and you've got to cover it in paint, most artists would think, oh, like Picasso when he painted Guernica, which is a picture the same size, took months, did drawings and sketches, did revision, thought about it, changed it on the way. Emily started in that corner and painted through to that corner, and that picture is the result. It's an absolutely unbelievable task to have a whole picture in your head and consistently go from one corner to the next corner and arrive so you can step off the end of the canvas and walk away. It's a defiant act and absolutely, absolutely states very clearly how she had the whole of Al-Alqra right in her mind. It was there. The one on the right, a bold and gestural picture, is a different sort of a picture, and it was painted in a day in between going to the doctor in the morning and going back for the results in the afternoon. And it's got a beautiful gestural, it's lyrical, it's got that tension in it. Great picture. And this is probably the last big commission that she did for the Queensland Art Gallery when her retrospective was planned. This is the exhibition that Margot curated in the Queensland Gallery. And when I talked to her about it, I said, explained that this was a picture that was going to be right along one big wall and everyone was going to see it. And that Margot had asked me, could she do everything about Al-Alqra in this one picture? And so this painting was done in little groups of different pieces. You can see the groupings there, the black and white stripes at the ends, the vertical stripes which are in this exhibition, and these more gestural menageries at the end. Beautiful paintings, conceived in a completely new way to anything that she'd done before. The big pieces before had been more or less the colours that all matched each other, but in this one, there's sequences of work which really define how she was thinking about Al-Alqra at the time. And that's M. Oh, that's all right. Questions? There's a lady.
It's nice to say a name and anything else that might be relevant. Thank you.
Thanks. I just wanted to ask a question about Emily's material. Sorry. I just wanted to ask a question about Emily's materials. Did she sort of request certain colours and canvases of a specific size, or did she work mainly for commission, like?
Yes, no, and yes. She, do you know that picture that the Al-Alqra suite, the big blue, purpley, greeny coloured thing? Emily asked I discussed it with her. I said we can do lots of little things can make one big thing. Yep, she said that's good. Then she said paint it yellow. I want it all painted yellow. And so Rodney mixed up all this paint, painted it all yellow for her. And when it was finished, you can't see any yellow. There's only these little tiny bits of yellow. I asked her specifically, could she think about doing... I never tell artists what to do, but there was a commission that was coming through, and I said, can we think about doing this picture and discuss the colours and things? And I even bought a big box of colours, and I said, these sorts of colours. And she said, yeah. The picture ended up being completely different to the box of colours that were there, right? Not like she hadn't even used the colours that were in the box. And so... she was really independent, really independent. And at times, she want lots of colours, but sometimes, like I know lots of artists, and they'll say, oh, you know, I'd like to have, do this picture, it's going to be green and blue and stuff. And in the process of being a real artist, things change. And so the answer is that I'm sure some people said, you know, today it's black and white and that's that, you know. But my experience was always that artists, the true artists, find their ways. There's another picture back there that I showed you that it was sort of a yellowy, browny picture, and I said you can see the lines and you can see the maps. Underneath that is greens and pinks and mauves, and there's a whole other painting underneath it that's been covered over. And I suppose the most perverse thing I can tell you is that once she did a painting, it was about this big, and in the middle there was a little mark, a tiny mark. It was a beautiful painting in subtle creams and pinks and whites, and it was a really lovely, subtle picture. And the woman who owned it said that it had damage in the middle and it needed fixing. And I had a look at it and I said, well, okay, I'll just take it to a restorer and get it fixed for you. It wasn't significant. It was insignificant damage, right? The sort of damage that a pedant would find and wouldn't be able to live with. Anyway, the woman insisted that it gets fixed by Emily Nuare. No one else but Emily Nuare. She used chocolate brown and painted in the centre of the picture a big field of chocolate brown dots. That's perverse, isn't it? I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, sure. I just thought maybe that would account. I was wondering whether that would account for some of the sort of drastic stylistic shifts, depending on
the interesting. Well, when you see the big shifts in stylistic shifts, there's a big picture out here called Earth's Creation. And it's a picture that I used to hate. But I actually saw it in... I never liked it because it just didn't do it for me. I didn't like the colours. In Tokyo, it was hung in a new way, and I actually changed my mind. And I thought, no, I've got to pay respect to that picture. It is very smart. But it's a picture that was painted in about 2 years after it should have been. It's sort of like revision. It's sort of looking back on the past. And I guess that's what I didn't like about it. It was sort of like she was painting stripes over here and then she was painting this. But I've since mellowed and I can see it. But that's where you do get people. In 1989, she was painting little lines on the side of the canvas, and that was a natural follow-on from what she was doing in Batik. And in about 1991, certain dealers were getting her to paint little stripes on the side of the canvases again to give them that old look. But she's a consummate artist. And even when she was doing this exhibition, every picture in that exhibition out there is a serious work of art by Emily Nuare. There's not one picture out there she hasn't worked on. And if you hear anyone casting any aspersions on the quality or where those pictures come from or the authenticity of those pictures, they don't know what they're talking about. Those pictures out there, there's not one I wouldn't stake my life on. And they didn't all come through me, you know, so that they're all good pictures. But there's a whole other side of Emily Nuare's work, which was the production line work, which I don't think there's any doubt had the assistance of others in the community to do. But as I've said to many, many people, you look at the quality of the work, you look at the good pictures, and they've all got that magic hand of Nuare in them. She's the only one that could handle the space, the only one that the pictures have depth and life. And so, does that help?
Ian Hodgson. It's been said, and this follows on a bit from what you've just said, actually, it's been said that not all Emily's paintings are masterpieces or first class, and that some of them are not very good. Did you feel that when you were working with her? Did Emily recognise that herself? And what was your reaction to it, and what was her reaction to your reaction?
I think the statement that I make in an essay that I've written previously was that there are a number of people that got work from Emily Nuare, and on the whole, they got what they deserved, and that's how I'd answer your question. There are masterpieces, and there are other works that are just terrific works, but there is a series of works that. Unfortunately, I didn't have to handle any of these works, but there are a series of works that I've seen on the out in the marketplace in Alice Springs, in the tourist shops in Alice Springs. There were paintings there that I don't care who did them. I don't care if Emily did them, but they were just production line paintings. They had no heart. They had no soul. They were very decorative, very flat pictures. And you know that's how I separate the chart. I said, people come and ask me all the time, how do I tell if it's a fake or not? I said, forget if it's a fake. When any artist, you know, Arthur Boyd, not every picture was the masterpiece. And how do you react when an artist doesn't do a masterpiece? You just put it to one side. You know, well, Arthur Boyd didn't. He put him in the auction, but, you know, that's cheeky. No. Any more questions? There you go. That was easy. Thanks for having me.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.